Hi. So I'm Dave Robson from NSC. So basically, I'm an analyst, work for a commercial organisation, but do a lot of support to things like DSTL, Command and Staff College, and sort of things like that. Do a lot of work on exercise design, but originally had a software engineering background, so that's kind of the bias. So the stuff we've been working on in the last couple of years, to put this in a bit of context, we've had this problem of how we build the next generation simulations. So I've sort of spent 20 odd years building big kinetic war games and things, all great fun, but we're hitting some problems. Non-linear battle space is a big one, so I would say the idea that you haven't got a FIBA anymore, you've got isolated pockets of units moving through quite a complex terrain. The problem of urban environments is something that's come up quite high. Cyber and how we put SEMA, those wider electromagnetic effects. And the big one that I'm going to sort of go on about today is how we deal with this sort of impact of the human terrain on military operations. And again, sort of bias, do a lot of command and control exercises. So that was the prime case we were looking at. But we had intended that you could use this for operational analysis. And we're quite cognizant of the problem of data visualization and how we get that information back to the training audience. So the sort of aspirations of the human terrain bit of the models that we've been working on, again, it's for training and analysis work. We've got the issue that a lot of the military scenarios we work with, training exercises and serials, are working in fictitious areas, sort of made up parts of the world. The problem with that is that we haven't got the usual data sources. So I can't go to Facebook, get a human terrain sort of model from the likes of that, and just plug it in. Although we can use some of that to inform what we're doing. One thing we were very keen on is real world, you get some very complex feedback loops in terms of population behavior. We actually wanted to smooth a lot of that out because again, it breaks the training benefit that we're trying to do. And anything we built had to be able to link to other models, particularly our existing kinetic models, because no one's going to give me a few million pounds to rewrite those tomorrow. And the kind of things we're interested in was information operations, what happens with kinetic effects, how that impacts the human terrain, and sort of environmental, and by that I mean critical national infrastructure, power, water, those types of disruptions. And I can't sort of stress enough, the real problem we have is the low cost of tools. I can buy some lovely commercial models if I've got a few million pounds. Typical military exercise, I've got a few tens of thousands of pounds to do all the data prep and deliver an exercise. So we just couldn't use a lot of the existing methods. The way we chose to tackle that, project that's been running, DSTL have done a fair chunk of the funding on this. We've put some of our own effort in. We're about the first of three intended phases on it, so it's early days. But what we're interested in doing was it was looking at the impact of influence and cyber operations on the human terrain, but working on the idea, we're very focused on that higher tactical level. So the sort of target audience is your battalion to brigade headquarters. It's that sort of focus. One thing I would stress is we were only interested in building an indicative model. We have absolutely no aspirations on building something that is predictive, that will say what would happen in real world things. And I have a fairly strong opinion on how you can or can't do that for real. So methodology, how we went about it. I'll go into a little bit more detail on two or three of these as we go on, but obviously hit the academic studies. There has been a lot of work done on this, particularly in the last 5 years. So for instance, into the mix went social interaction models, a fair chunk of stuff post-Afghanistan on counterinsurgency operations and how the view on those has changed. Big chunk on urban modeling, and something I'll come on to a little bit later, a huge source of information that's come from modeling infectious diseases. A lot of the questions and the issues we have already been tackled and with an awful lot of rigor. So we looked at COTS gaming solutions, not surprising. Because of this cost of building data sets, open source data, something we could build from that was key. And the basic process, build a notional model, see if we can code that into a prototype software application to check it works, put that in front of a test training audience, and just check we're going in the right direction. So two areas I'll go into in slightly more detail. First thing is quite a lot of work being done on urban areas and cities. I'll reference just one main book is probably the main point. So David Kilcullen's done quite an influential book on Out of the Mountains. So he's making an argument there on how cities work as a social nexus, if you like. So whereas a lot of our war games, we tend to avoid the urban as it's been too complicated, we need to get some fidelity into there. One of the key things is they exert a very strong influence over a surrounding area, partly because they're the nexus for a lot of trade links and communication links, but also this problem of transient populations. So you tend to have a lot of people working from or coming from a sort of extra urban area into the urban thing, doing their day-to-day business and going back out again, taking influence and flows with them. And the last thing is this idea of it being a contested between different factions. Big source for us when we were looking at, was this even possible to do this? We referenced the counterinsurgency games by GMT. If you haven't looked at them, can't give them a strong enough shout out. But we took a couple of basic outcomes from having played these. So the first is you do not need a super detailed terrain in terms of classic sort of war games that we've been building have anything up to a million hexes. You want to be going as far the other direction as you can. So the idea of splitting things into provinces or irregular blocks, the idea that conflict being resourced rather than firepower limited, so things like flows of logistics and resource become a key thing in the model, and the idea that you probably want more than two protagonists if you're trying to get a complex narrative, and that's the thing that starts getting you thinking about some of the issues. And the last one, just as a generic thing we had, you always know what forces are in an area. That doesn't mean you can do anything about them. So the idea that you know there are people operating there, but you can't geolocate. So we built a notional model, and the plan was to code up different sections of this. The green areas at the top, basically we bounded our existing air, land, and maritime models, stuck them, left them pretty much unchanged, but you're going to need an interface module, this combat model aggregator. That's the thing that then talks with your social interaction and your comms models, and it's the social interaction model was the thing that we prioritized development on for this phase of the exercise. What I'm going to suggest is, because time's short, if you want details on those, we'll come back onto those. So first thing that we did on thinking, how do we split this human terrain up in terms of geography? We need geography because we need to link it back to the kinetic models and the sort of military operation side. What we did find is that actually just go back, hit some census data, and you'll find someone's done an awful lot of the work for you. So we typically split things on administrative regions, and what we found is that there is an echo of the human terrain topography on those sort of structures. Critical to separate urban and rural terrain blocks, if you like, into different areas. And we referenced a lot of the work that NATO ACT has been doing on urban terrain zone classifications for that. We've got the idea of local of populations being able to move from one of these regions to another, but just a background flow. And then you overlay a mass transport network on top of that to deal with your fast flows. And the idea that any one of those regions can be contested by multiple different groups. So we're going to need to get that into the system as well. Something that came out from the coin games is that if you've got a typical training audience, 10 to 20 zones to deal with is a massive complexity. In many cases, we were finding 6 to 8 was enough to really challenge an audience and to get them thinking about what was going on. So the idea of factions, a few people have been talking about this over the last couple of days. There isn't just the military and the civil. There is an awful lot more going on. And what we found is that to get a good flow, you probably want about half a dozen to a dozen of these different groups that are going on. Each have got their own objectives. They don't all need to be played as such, but they are flows that are happening within the system. And the one that does keep coming out is this idea of this sort of criminal grey market, if you like, is normally the dominant flow in an area when you're not talking about government, and it tends to be the key thing that a lot of the hybrid actors, if you like, are trying to manipulate. So we had the idea then, just what principle were we going to use to split one of these factions down? There are many different social models you could use. The one we picked was going down the group dynamics route. And the reason for that is one of the key people who we were talking to were the influence operations cells, particularly with some other NATO countries, and this is a focus that they like to use on training. And we've taken a particular slice through that of this idea of a group called a category. So that's a group you self-identify with, and it tends to map particularly well with some of the sort of quasi-political or sort of tribal elements that we've been working with. The other social groups are replicated by other factors in the model. I said that we'd have a quick look at stuff that came from some of the infectious disease modelling. And what we found was a really rich data source looking at how people interact. So we made an early decision that one of the key focuses was going to be people's face-to-face communication. Lots of models we've got will do social media. We have put social media in the system, but as a smoothing element. So the primary information flow is me going, meeting a group of colleagues, friends, neighbours, whatever, talking with them, and that's how influence has been spread through the system. And what we found were some really interesting tables showing things like what the impact of people's age on how they interact and who they interact with. So age became a key factor. And the second one that we found was a very big difference between different cultures, even within a European context. So the particular example we've got there, bottom line being grey, is German. So if you're a German teen, the data set here says over a 24-hour period, you've got typically 10 meaningful, 15 minutes or more interactions with another person of that cohort. When we look at, say, the Italians, we're almost off the chart at sort of 25 to 30. So you can use these data sets also then to build a set of cultural differences into the system. You also need a concept of cultural distance. So if we've got elements from different factions talking to each other, they don't always communicate perfectly, and there are different social models you could use for that. The one we used as a placeholder was a thing called a Lewis model. Very simple, easy to describe. You'll find it in various sort of business communication textbooks and things. It actually worked very well for the test audiences. There is a more sophisticated one that we have just started using where you can, rather than just a generic communication factor, you can start looking at the vector that communication took place in. The only thing I will say with that is it makes the output of the model more complex for the training audience to understand. So then, by the time we mix all that together, how we divided the population down. So we've taken this concept of a population group, and what we wanted to do is rather than model individuals in the system, which computationally got too difficult, we'll break people down typically into groups of 50 or 100 people. And the key thing is that they've got the same home zone, so the place that they're residing overnight, neighbours. They've got a common place that they're moving during the day. Call it a work zone, but that covers things like going shopping, going to school, those sorts of concepts. They belong to a shared faction, so we can aggregate their behaviours in terms of that cultural flow. And a common age band, because we found age was critical on who you talk to and how frequently. Built a daily activity cycle, and then what we've done is built a set of semi-autonomous software agents, one representing each one of those population groups. So you can see the model already. If you've got a dozen regions, hundreds of these population groups per region, you've got thousands of moving parts. And this is why you end up having to use, you know, some reasonable computers to actually handle it. And we've also put in the concept that there are some regions which are not geographically linked to the main ones within the exercise area. And that gives us this idea of a diaspora that you might be reaching back to purely across electronic media. So then the next thing that we've got is this idea of a message model. So we've got all these people, they're moving around this terrain, interacting with each other, but we wanted the information that's flowing between them. So we took the concept that influence could be described as, call it an atomic unit of information, which is what we've called a message. And what we're encoding is the support for one faction against another. So an event happens, police go and raid a house, and a particular group might see that as being something threatening, another group might see that as something very positive. We model those as software agents themselves. We use this idea of cultural distance to limit how far them, how easy it is for those messages to pass from one person to another, and also the on the chance of whether it's been comprehended. So the greater the cultural distance, the more chance that a message will distort or evolve as it's moving through the population flow. And the implication of that is by the time you've got a message stack within each one of those population groups, tens of messages per one, you've actually got several thousand of these flowing through the system. But an interesting thing we saw is that you start getting evolutionary effects, and that actually starts replicating some of the things we see in the real world. So a positive message tends to amplify through the system. A lot of low-key, boring messages, if you like, can actually help dampen that down. And that's then got some things then on how we put the population group behavior in. So the key metric we're measuring on this first phase is a population group holds support for all of the other factions in the system, including themselves or their own group. And the implication of that is that you might belong to, you know, a particular urban workers group, but doesn't necessarily mean you support their objectives, and things that happen within the system can shift that. And as I said earlier, we've got this idea of a social media thing, and effectively the way we put that is a smoothing model running through the system. So then the kind of outputs that we can get from the system as it exists at the moment, what we're actually plotting, if you like, is the change of support either on a regional basis or across the whole model for one faction against another. We've got this idea of competitive control. So if one element goes, if your support for a particular group goes up, by definition, the others are going down. And we have started to pair some of those groups together. So they become directly antagonistic. Because it's quite early days, we can give a basic plot of sentiments, either across the entire thing or on a region by region basis. And the other thing we've built is the ability to analyze a particular message or a particular inject you've put in the system, how it's flowed between the different population elements, and so you can see how it's distorted and evolved. So where we've got onto this, I think we've managed to demonstrate that we can actually build an effective information flow through a human terrain. The interesting bit that we found is in building the data sets actually taught us quite a lot that we could apply straight to the manual wargaming as well. So it was an interesting way of analysing the basic problem. And what I would say is we've got this thing, this assumption that it's almost impossible to build these things without social media data. Actually, by the time you hit census data, infection modelling and other things, you can actually build certainly things with sufficient complexity to challenge a training audience. And the model as it exists in the moment works best on a regional focus and is that kind of brigade level interactions. And I have got a question slide, but I believe we're leaving that till later. Thanks.